I want you to imagine, just for a second, a really brutal contrast. Picture yourself in this absolute, just peaceful tranquility of a residential studio in Whittier, California.
Oh, wow. Okay, setting a scene.
Yeah, right. So it's October of 2022. You're sitting in this quiet, sun-drenched corner of the world. There's a silent room, you know, pristine blank piece of paper, some jars of clear water, and a few earth-toned pigments just scattered around. It is the very definition of calm.
Right. That sounds almost entirely isolated from the rest of the world. Just pure still focus.
Exactly. But inside the mind of the artist sitting in that Californian studio, that quiet sun just, it literally doesn't exist at all. Instead, there is this deafening, roaring chaos.
A total mental shift.
Yeah. There's thick, dense smoke in the air. There's the sharp sting of tear gas. Thousands upon thousands of voices screaming in absolute unison. And the very asphalt beneath their feet is just vibrating from the sheer physical weight of a giant moving crowd. We are talking about the boiling, explosive streets of the 2021 Colombian protests. And that massive collision, you know, between the total peace of a studio and the visceral, violent memory of a country on fire is exactly the ecosystem we are stepping into today for this deep dive.
I mean, you really cannot separate that environmental whiplash from the artwork we're looking at today. We are examining a watercolor painting called Estallido Social, which translates to social outburst, created by the artist Jaro Duque.
And just to set some expectations for you listening, our mission today is not to give you, like, some dry textbook art critique where we just look at the colors and nod politely.
No, definitely not.
Right. We're going to unpack how the literal physical decisions of applying water and pigment directly mirror the complex political and social roots of a massive movement.
And to do that, we are pulling from an incredibly rich stack of sources. So we have the high-resolution image of the artwork itself, the technical sheet detailing its physical construction, and crucially, Jaro Duque's own personal notes.
Right. The notes are amazing.
They really are. He extensively documented his creative process and, you know, the specific political roots that fueled his inspiration.
But before we get into the paint and the paper,
mm-hmm.
we actually need to pause and talk about those political roots he mentions, because they are dense.
Yeah, very dense.
Duque specifically cites some incredibly complex systemic issues in his notes, like he points to the monopolies of the media, the suffocating weight of the financial sector, and deep institutional corruption.
Right.
And he positions all of this collective frustration as the direct antecedent that eventually paved the way for the progressive government of Gustavo Petro. So just a quick note on how we're approaching this today. Duque is very clear about his politics.
Extremely clear, yeah.
We, however, are not here to debate or endorse those politics, nor are we here to dismiss them. We just want to put that out there.
Exactly. Our focus is purely analytical. We are looking at these politically charged concepts solely to understand the mechanics of how an artist takes those very heavy partisan ideas and literally paints them into the paper.
Right, because knowledge is most valuable when we can step back and analyze the mechanics of expression without getting lost in an ideological debate.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand the delicate water-based techniques happening on the surface of this painting, we actually have to start with the extreme, almost absurd physical foundation required to just hold the thing together.
Yeah, the paper itself.
Right. And that journey starts with Duque's own personal foundation.
Right.
I mean, he wasn't just a tourist watching the news from afar, right?
No, not at all. The sources highlight that he lived in these specific popular neighborhoods in Colombia, completely fused with the community, for 40 years before he emigrated.
40 years. I mean, that lived experience completely changes the texture of the work.
It does. He went from being a kid playing on those rough cobblestone streets to marching on those exact same streets once they were paved and overflowing with protesters.
Wow.
He calls this a pictorial memory. It's an artwork that traveled from his deep memories of Colombia to the studio in California, all the way to an exhibition at the Nicolet Gallery in Berlin in July of 2023.
That is a wild journey for a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And speaking of the paper, preserving a 40-year memory of a country in upheaval requires a very specific physical vessel.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at the technical sheet, and it says he used Arches cold-pressed 640-gram paper. When I read that, I was genuinely confused. I mean, I know standard watercolor paper is maybe, what, 140 grams?
Yeah, around there. 140 is standard.
So 640 grams is massive. It sounds less like a canvas and more like, I don't know, armored cardboard. And what does cold pressed even mean here? And why would he need something so absurdly thick?
So cold press just means the paper is manufactured in a way that leaves a highly textured, almost bumpy surface, unlike smooth hot pressed paper.
Okay.
Those tiny bumps are crucial because they act like little reservoirs to trap the water. And he needed that 640 gram thickness because of the unforgiving physics of watercolor.
Wait, unforgiving. Watercolor seems so peaceful.
It seems peaceful, but watercolor is inherently destructive to its own canvas. When you apply water to paper, the cellulose fibers expand, which causes the paper to warp, buckle, and if you use enough water, it ultimately disintegrates.
Oh, wow. So the paper is essentially a sponge wrapped in a straitjacket. It has to absorb a massive flood without losing its structural integrity.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. If you apply the destructive amounts of water that Duke's vision demanded onto standard paper, the piece would literally destroy itself before it was finished.
That is wild.
Yeah, the canvas had to act like a rigid structural wall to sustain the absolute deluge of water he was pouring onto it.
I am stuck on one detail here, though. He builds this absolute fortress of a canvas to handle a flood of water in order to capture his own deeply personal visceral memory, right?
Right.
Yet the sources say he actually used cell phone photographs pulled from the web as his primary visual references. I have to push back on that.
Oh, really? How so?
Well, if this is meant to be a raw depiction of his 40 years in that neighborhood, isn't relying on random internet photos a bit detached? Like, doesn't crowdsourcing the images dilute the personal nature of the work?
See, that's an interesting point, but if he had painted this strictly from his own isolated memory, he would have created a singular, narrow perspective.
Meaning.
It would have been just his protest. By pulling photographs taken by hundreds of anonymous cell phones during the actual 2021 protests, he is actively absorbing the collective gaze.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, he's letting the community dictate the visual reality of the moment rather than just forcing his own memory onto the canvas.
Ah, so he is crowdsourcing the perspective to make it more authentic to the masses rather than just authentic to himself. That makes a lot of sense.
Exactly. And once he brings that collective vision to the heavy paper, the water basically does the rest of the work.
What do you mean?
By applying massive amounts of water onto an already wet surface, he intentionally blurs and dilutes the specific identities of the people in those reference photos.
Wow, so he washes away the individuals completely.
Yes. He washes them away to construct what he calls a choral dimension.
A choral dimension. Man, that phrase really sticks with you.
It really does. It implies that there is no soloist in this painting. You aren't meant to be looking at one specific person's face or analyzing one person's grief.
Right, because there are no clear faces.
Exactly. You are looking at the entire choir resonating as a single, unified social pulse. The physics of the water literally forces the figures to bleed into one another until they become one massive breathing organism.
So they bleed into one single organism. But, looking at the piece, this organism isn't just a flat, chaotic puddle. It has a distinct skeleton. You almost feel like you're standing at the bottom of a steep hill, looking up at the composition. It's built in these distinct ascending planes.
Yeah, the anatomy of the composition is heavily engineered to guide your emotional response.
Right.
Starting at the bottom, you are confronted with this dense, compact mass of the crowd. And as your eye moves up to the center, which is slightly elevated, you find the visual axis of the painting, which is a group of youth holding flags. Looming over all of it at the very top is this incredibly dense sky, painted with thick layers of ochre and brown pigments.
Yeah, I kept looking at those brown skies. They do not look like weather.
No, they don't.
I mean, it doesn't look like a cloudy day or an incoming storm. It looks unnatural, almost heavy. It feels less like a meteorological feature and more like a physical ceiling pressing down on the people below.
What's fascinating here is that heaviness is entirely deliberate. Duke designed it as a physical ceiling. The artist explicitly notes that this brown sky is a visual metaphor for historical tension.
Historical tension. Like the weight of the past.
Exactly. It is meant to evoke the scraped asphalt from the barricades, the suffocating smoke of the tear gas, the sheer volume of dust kicked up by thousands upon thousands of marching feet,
Wow.
and above all, an immense, almost paralyzing sense of exhaustion that comes from decades of inequality.
You really feel that exhaustion, dragging your eyes downward into the dirt. But then, right in the center, you have these primary colors. The yellow, the blue, the red of the Colombian flags.
Yes, the visual anchor.
But again, he plays with our expectations here. These are not bright, victorious parade day colors. They are stained.
He creates a masterful visual tension between the layers. The bottom mass and the heavy brown sky are actively pulling you down with the weight of that marginalization.
Right, like gravity.
Yes. But those flags, held by the youth in the center, force your eyes upward against the gravity of the painting. The colors of the flags are intentionally stained by the atmosphere of the conflict.
It looks so dirty.
They are filthy with the dust of the street, which tells the viewer that this hope isn't naive or pure. It is battered, it is exhausted, but it is still defiantly held high.
It's a hope that has been dragged through the mud but refuses to drop.
Perfectly said.
And that tension isn't just, you know, a conceptual art theory. It's tied to very specific real-world geography that he mentions in his notes.
Yes, absolutely.
Even though the faces are blurred into this choral dimension, he anchors the painting in specific locations that were epicenters of the uprising.
The geography is vital to understanding the scale of the 2021 unrest. He references famous resistance points in the city of Cali, specifically places like Puerto Resistencia.
I've heard of that. That wasn't just a street corner, right?
No, it was an intersection originally called Puerto Elena that the protesters essentially took over. They renamed it and built a literal multi-story physical monument to the resistance right in the middle of the road.
Wow, they built a monument during the protest.
Yes, it became an autonomous zone. He also mentions Siloe, which is a steep working-class neighborhood built into the hillsides of Cali, an area with a long history of systemic marginalization.
So these were historically invisible sectors that suddenly became the beating arteries of the entire social outburst.
Exactly.
And his notes point out that it didn't stay contained to Cali. The movement rapidly spilled over any kind of institutional calculation.
It just expanded exponentially.
Yeah, it expanded into massive working class areas of Bogota, like the sprawling districts of Kennedy and Suba, and surged into industrial zones across the entire country.
And Duke captures that shift from invisibility to visibility in a very specific way within the composition.
How so?
While the water washes out the faces and the identities, preserving the anonymity of the crowd, there are sharp, distinct visual anchor points scattered throughout the dark mass.
Oh, here's where it gets really interesting for me. Throughout this heavy, brown, exhausted crowd, you see these tiny, distinct white flashes of light.
Yes, the white dots.
When I first look at it, it instantly reminded me of being at a rock concert. You know that moment at the climax of a show when the lights go down and suddenly 50,000 people turn on their cell phone flashlights?
Yeah, it's totally that vibe.
It is this overwhelming sea of tiny, sharp stars piercing through the dark.
Those flashes represent exactly that phenomenon, cell phone lights or candles held by individual protesters.
Wow, just dots of light in the smoke.
In the context of this grueling, suffocating protest under that brown sky, each of those white flashes serves a crucial function. They represent a collective cry of, here we are, we exist.
It anchors you to the humanity of the crowd.
Exactly.
Without those lights, the painting might just look like a hostile, anonymous wash of brown and gray water. The lights remind you that there are actual, breathing human beings inside that crushing atmosphere, refusing to be erased.
Right. Each flash is an individual adding their personal force to the collective. But, you know, it is vital to notice what is not illuminated by those flashes.
Okay, I struggled with one thing looking at this piece, actually.
What's that?
Well, in most traditional historical art paintings that capture massive national upheavals or revolutions, like the famous paintings of the French Revolution, there's always a protagonist.
Always a hero.
Yeah, there's always a guy on a white horse with a sword drawn or someone standing on a barricade waving a flag, leading the charge.
Right, the traditional center of attention.
But in Estilito Social, my eye has nowhere to land. There is no central figure. Nobody is leading them.
Duke made a deeply ethical decision to omit a central messianic leader. He is actively rejecting the historical concept of the Caudillo.
The Caudillo?
Yeah, a Caudillo is a traditional military or political strongman. It's a figure who usually takes control and gives orders from a podium, shaping history through their individual will.
Oh, gotcha.
Duke is saying this was not a movement orchestrated by a strongman. It was a horizontal movement. It was driven entirely by the grassroots.
So how does an artist visually sustain something so massive, so full of energy and momentum, when our brains are so trained to look for a main character? Like, how does the painting not just fall flat?
The absence is the message. By refusing to paint a hero, Duke forces you to look at the mass itself. The mass occupies the space because it is their inherent right to be there, not because they are blindly following a leader.
The collective is the protagonist.
Yes. And this focus on the collective really crystallizes when you look at the broader context of Duke's work.
Oh, right, the series.
Yeah, the sources mention that Estilito Social is actually the second of five works in a specific series called Simplemente Protesta, or Simply Protest.
And the contrast with the first painting in that series is very revealing about how social movements evolve, right?
Oh, absolutely. The first piece is called Arte en Resistencia, Art in Resistance. The artist's notes describe that earlier work as a poetic gesture confronting violence head on.
Okay, so a direct confrontation.
Yeah, it was about direct clash. The initial brutal point of friction between protesters and the state.
It captures the exact moment the mash strikes the rough surface.
What a great way to put it, yes.
But Estilito Social represents the fire spreading. It is the expansion. It's no longer just a localized clash in one neighborhood. It is the entire social body, the entire country, moving and breathing together.
It captures the sustained, exhausting reality of a nationwide uprising. Which brings a whole new level of gravity to the physical materials he used.
Looping us back to where we started.
Exactly. We are talking about a monumental, heavy historical earthquake of a movement. We are talking about vibrating asphalt, thousands of people, tear gas, the weight of decades of corruption and monopolies.
It's just massive.
And to capture all of that crushing weight, he uses watercolor.
It is the absolute last medium you would expect. It is inherently fragile. It is literally water that evaporates into thin air, leaving behind these thin layers of pigment.
Right, it's so delicate.
You'd think a subject this heavy would demand cast bronze, or like thick, heavy layers of oil paint violently scraped onto a massive canvas. But he deliberately uses a transient, delicate medium to depict a permanent, aggressive historical shift. So what does this all mean?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the choice of watercolor is a profound statement on the nature of history and art itself.
How so?
Duke is telling us that this movement is not a static, dead monument. It's not a rigid bronze statue of a general on a horse gathering pigeon droppings in a city square.
Wow, okay, yeah.
It is a living, breathing, fluid organism. Water is life. It moves, it flows, it changes shape, and it finds a way through the cracks of even the most rigid structures.
By capturing it this way, the artwork serves a vital democratic function. It legitimizes mass protest as a necessary living component of a functioning society rather than just an angry riot.
Exactly. It pushes back against official institutional narratives that often try to demonize or simplify these massive social outbursts into mere vandalism.
Right. They try to dismiss it.
By immortalizing the movement in watercolor, he ensures that the raw, chaotic, exhausted voices of the people on those streets aren't diluted by history, which is highly ironic considering he used a technique based entirely on diluting pigments with water.
It is an incredible irony. He took water, he took earth-toned pigments, he took 40 years of his own lived memory, and he took a piece of paper built to act like a structural wall. And from a quiet, sunlit studio in California, he built a visceral, undeniable record of 2021 Colombia. He painted a massive history-altering movement without a single leader, illuminated only by thousands of individual flashes of light.
He captured the absolute fragility of a crowd and the overwhelming, unstoppable force of what happens when that fragile crowd decides to move as one unified body.
It really reframes how you think about the tools we use to document our lives and our struggles. And that actually brings us to a thought we want to leave you with today, drawn straight from the thematic core of the artist's work.
Yeah, think about the seemingly fragile, fleeting things you interact with every day.
Right, a simple text message, a quick passing chat with a neighbor on the street, a photo on your phone that you don't think twice about, much like the cell phone photos Duke used for his references.
If an incredibly fragile, transient technique like watercolor, something that literally evaporates into the air, can be manipulated to capture and preserve monumental, history-altering changes,
yeah.
What fragile tools in your hands right now are silently sculpting the history of tomorrow?
That is just, wow, it's a powerful reminder that history isn't just carved in stone by leaders or dictated from a podium. It is painted in water by the collective.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive. Keep asking questions. Keep looking closely at the details around you. And we will catch you next time as we unpack another incredible topic. Take care.